And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, coronavirus cases continue to climb in the Pacific Northwest and throughout the world. Multnomah County and Portland promise more help for the houseless in crisis, and unemployment claims reach record levels. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 26th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. The United States has the most confirmed coronavirus cases in the world, with 82,404. According to the Wall Street Journal, the U.S. has now overtaken China as the country with the worst outbreak of the disease. This comes just 6 weeks after the first case in the United States, which was a man in Washington state who had traveled to Wuhan, China, and that case was reported on January 21st. Over 3 million Americans applied for unemployment benefits last week, an alarming indicator of the economic damage the coronavirus outbreak is having on the nation. With layoffs accelerating, industries especially hard hit include restaurants, bars, hotels, gyms, airlines, and movie theaters. Previous records for unemployment were set in 1982. Last week's records was five times that. Economists have theorized that U.S. unemployment rates could rise to 13%, a surge Oxford economics consultant Nancy Van Vardenhouten, calling the largest economic contraction on record with the most severe surge in unemployment ever. According to the U.S. Labor Department, further complications exist as websites and phone lines are overwhelmed with incoming claims, resulting in frozen sites and busy signals. The nearly finalized economic relief bill could provide an additional $600 a week on top of aid states can provide, along with extensions up to 13 weeks beyond state limitations. The proposed new legislation would also extend unemployment benefits to non-payroll employees, freelancers, and gig workers for the first time. The U.S. Senate has passed a massive $2 trillion stimulus package to try and assuage the economic impact of the coronavirus pandemic. The 880-page bill was passed late Wednesday in a unanimous 96-0 vote. The measure will provide billions of dollars in credit for struggling industries, a boost to employment insurance, as well as direct cash payments for Americans. Under the plan, adults earning up to $75,000 a year are expected to receive a check for $1,200, in addition to $500 per child. The bill would also include about $100 billion in funding for hospitals, $350 billion for small businesses, $500 billion for corporations, including airlines and cruise lines, as well as about $150 billion for state and local stimulus funds. The bill would also increase the maximum state unemployment benefit by $600 per week. The agreement prohibits business controlled by Trump and members of Congress from receiving loans from Treasury programs. The House is expected to vote on the stimulus bill on Friday. Democratic House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer of Maryland said this would allow legislators enough time to review the bill since its final wording was not released until late Wednesday. President Donald Trump also said on Wednesday that he would sign the legislation if it reaches his desk. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said that because of members in self-quarantine, limited flight operations, and stay-at-home orders in some states, the House will likely pass the measure through a voice vote. This means that members will yell out aye or no, and the Speaker will determine the outcome of the vote based on which is the loudest. House Republican leaders are recommending that their members vote in favor of the bill. The Oregon Health Authority said today that one additional person has died in the state of COVID-19. This brings the state's total death toll up to 11, while confirmed cases in the state have increased to 317. The most recent death was a 69-year-old woman from Clackamas County who had an underlying medical condition. In the past 24 hours, 50 additional Oregonians have been tested positive for the virus. This includes residents from Clatsop, Deschutes, Josephine, Lane, Lynn, Marion, Multnomah, Polk, Tillamook, Wasco, and Washington counties. That's a lot. Yesterday, more than 1,500 new people received their coronavirus test results, up from 1,200 the previous day. At least 28% of Oregon's COVID-19 patients have been hospitalized at some point during their illness. Nationally, the number of cases continues to grow quickly. The U.S. now has the most confirmed cases in the world, As of Thursday morning, there are at least 81,321 cases, as confirmed by lab tests, and over 1,000 deaths. Across the globe, the pandemic has infected more than 489,500 people in at least 171 countries. As of Thursday afternoon, almost 22,000 people have died. Clark County's COVID case number shot up, as did Oregon's unemployment numbers. But there is help on the way for Multnomah County, for the Multnomah County houseless community. KBOO's Annette Newell has this local COVID update.
Clark County, Washington's coronavirus cases have more than doubled as of today, with 28 new positive cases, bringing the total there to 48. Five people have died in the county. As of today, Washington has confirmed almost 2,600 cases and 133 deaths. Oregon has had 268 confirmed cases and 10 deaths. The state of Oregon took in 75,500 new unemployment claims last week, a number 15 times higher than last week. That's according to today's new numbers from the Oregon Employment Department. This covers the days right after Governor Kate Brown ordered the closures of bars and restaurants to try to stop the spread of the new coronavirus. The new unemployment numbers are at an all-time record. Health industry experts looked at Kaiser Family Foundation data on hospital beds and doctors, and they ranked each state to highlight which states might have the highest capacity to deal with the coronavirus. They found Oregon ranked eighth worst for hospital capacity. Oregon has an average of 1.6 hospital beds and 2.9 certified physicians per 1,000 people. Overall, West Virginia, New York, and Pennsylvania ranked highest for hospital preparedness. Multnomah County leaders say they plan to have 4 temporary shelters for the houseless open by the end of next week. Then they'll open more shelter space for people who are sick and are living outside or in vehicles. But the catch is the county needs more people to work at the new shelters. So they're asking people with medical, behavioral, health, and social services experience to apply to work or volunteer at them. Last week, the county and the city of Portland announced their intent to open hundreds of shelter beds for houseless people who are not able to be at least 6 feet apart in shelters and to provide places for people who are sick but have no place to recover. The City and County Joint Office of Homeless Services has opened 250 beds. It plans to open the East Portland Community Shelter by the end of next week. The shelters are taking in people who are already in publicly funded shelters, moving them to spaces where they're not as crowded to prevent the spread of COVID-19. County officials ask employees to staff the shelters first on a voluntary basis. They're still paid but would work 8-hour shifts in shelters instead of from home. But even with large numbers of additional county staff and workers from nonprofits who are running already existing shelters, the county needs more people. So people who are interested in the work can apply on the county's website. Annette Newell for the KBOO Evening News.
Oregon Health and Science University is setting up a COVID-19 hotline that people can call if they think they have the virus. KBOO's Melissa Hood has the report.
OHSU spokeswoman Amanda Gibbs said a $1.6 million donation from the Andrew and Corey Morris Singer Foundation will cover the costs of dedicated phone lines and computers, as well as training for hotline staff. The COVID-19 hotline will be staffed by medical professionals, including doctors, registered nurses, public health educators, and community health workers. Gibbs said hospital administrators don't yet know when the service will start, but it will be made available to most of OHSU's clinics for at least the next 3 months. In addition to answering calls, the service may be extended to text and email. Gibbs added that the state's primary care system has been bombarded by calls about COVID-19 and that, quote, the hotline and telemedicine service will also help prevent OHSU's primary care system from becoming overwhelmed during the COVID-19 pandemic and will help prevent primary care clinics, urgent care, and emergency departments from becoming overcrowded with patients who could more appropriately be treated with telemedicine services. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Melissa Hood.
A stitch in time to help save lives. Salem Health is asking for your help in sewing protective masks for healthcare workers on the front lines of the COVID-19 crisis. Salem Hospital employees bagged hundreds of mask-making kits, enough for roughly 10,000 protective masks, and is asking those with a sewing machine, white thread, scissors, and a straight edge or cutting mat to assist during the ongoing pandemic. Materials provided include surgical paper, fabric, instructions, and a bag for the finished masks. Each household may take up to 2 kits, and each kit provides material for 30 to 50 masks. Health officials are urging volunteers to not use their own fabric. Mask kits can be picked up on Thursdays from 1 to 3 p.m. and on Fridays between 9 and 11 a.m. in Salem at the Town Park Security Booth at Southeast Mission Street and Southeast 25th Street, or in Dallas at the West Valley Hospital parking lot on Southeast Washington Street. When picking up a mask kit, officials are urging the public to maintain social distancing and stay in your vehicle. Staff members will bring supplies to you. The Oregon Health Authority has put out a call for health professional volunteers in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Health professionals can register with the State Emergency Registry of Volunteers in Oregon to offer their services locally or statewide. Oregon licensed, out-of-state, and previously licensed or retired professionals are all encouraged to apply. Volunteer duties depend on immediate needs and could include staffing the Oregon Medical Station in Salem, working an information hotline, or facilitating the mass distribution of medications. Hood River has ordered an immediate ban on recreational and discretional overnight stays in its attempt at fighting the ongoing coronavirus outbreak. The Columbia River Gorge City is a renowned hub for campers, windsurfers, and other outdoor and travel enthusiasts. Officials are maintaining this ban is only temporary. The ordinance applies to stays at motels, hotels, vacation rentals, RV parks, campgrounds, and bed and breakfasts. Those exempt from the ban include populations deemed vulnerable to COVID-19, long-term guests with commitments of 30 days or more, and essential personnel who need lodging for local work. The ban on overnighters is scheduled to last through April 14th. Many popular hiking trails along the Columbia Gorge are now closed to the public completely, including the viewing areas at Multnomah Falls. Similar measures have been taken throughout the state, notably at coastal communities, which approved similar bans following last weekend's surge of tourist influx. Portland Parks and Recreation closed several parks to vehicle traffic today to help promote safe social distancing practices and discourage overcrowding. However, the parks are still open to the public. KBOO's Annette Newell talked to Portland Parks spokesman Mark Ross for his thoughts on how people can use the parks and stay safe and healthy during the crisis.
Are you getting lots of questions from folks?
No, I think most people understand what they have to do, even though we all have a tough time accepting it. This is going to be a real benefit to the community by social distancing now, doing it stringently, keeping 6 feet apart. But we recognize that getting outside is really crucial, especially in these challenging times. We just have to do it safely because we need the entire community's input on, we need the entire community to adhere to these guidelines for everyone's health. We've got to give our healthcare system a chance. We have to, the more we do this now and social distance diligently and regularly and be stringent about it, the less perhaps we'll have to do it going forward. So we all have to do our part.
Yeah. Do you think there's any chance that they will close down the parks, the Portland parks, the way they have the state parks? If people
we haven't had any discussions around that yet, and it's a different kind of animal because state parks are mostly for camping. They have single entrance and exit points, so it's really a quite different situation. But right now we have the governor's direction, so our playgrounds are closed, our outdoor sports courts and fields are closed, and it's necessary to support public health and to limit the spread of this virus. The good news is our natural areas, our parks, our trails, our community gardens are open. Places where you can hike and bike and run and walk without close contact. And that's what we need to do. But please, if you have any symptom of any illness, stay home. Do not use the park. Wash your hands before and after you visit a park or natural area or any public space for that matter. And keep 6 feet away from others at all times. If you can't do it because it's too crowded, please go somewhere else or come back later.
Excellent. Okay, thank you. Is there anything else you would like to add?
These are challenging times, and it's requires some sacrifice right now so we can save lives and stop the spread. So let's work together. We need the compliance of the entire community. And I know Portland's got this because we got this, Portland.
All right. Thank you so much, Mark. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you for your interest.
That was Mark Ross from Portland Parks and Recreation talking to KBOO's Annette Newell. More information is available on the Bureau's COVID-19 webpage as well as on the City of Portland's webpage. Oregon labor unions are backing two ballot measures aimed at preventing legislators from walking out to avoid votes, according to Oregon Live. The first ballot measure would amend the state's constitution, preventing legislators with 10 unexcused absences from floor sessions from holding office in the next term. The second ballot measure would require legislators who miss the session without permission to pay a fine and forego salary and other compensation. The chief petitioners are Andrea Kennedy Smith, a vice president of the largest public employees union, and Reed Scott Schwalbach, a vice president of the statewide teachers association. The unions are hoping to get the required signatures to put the measure on the ballot for general election in November. The proposals follow the state's 2020 legislative session, which ended early after Republicans walked out over a greenhouse cap and trade bill. Attendance requirements to hold quorum during the last legislative session were not reached, which meant that majority Democrats could not pass Senate Bill 1530 or any others. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the role data privacy, or the lack thereof, is playing in the COVID-19 crisis. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, it's Indigenous Power Hour. Tonight's weather, we're looking at overcast skies with a few showers developing late, an overnight low down to 41. Tomorrow's weather, overcast with rain showers at times and a high of 51. Today in history, on this date in 1953, American medical researcher Dr. Johannes Salk announced that he successfully tested a vaccine against the virus that causes the crippling disease of polio. The quote of the day is from Salk, who said, "There is hope in dreams, imagination, and in the courage of those who wish to make those dreams a reality." This weekend, the first person in ICE custody tested positive for coronavirus, and immigrant advocates worry about how COVID-19 might spread in detention facilities. With more on the story, we go to Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process.
Now that you have coronavirus outbreaks at a detention center in Jersey, it's only a matter of time before we see that happen at other places.
On the first confirmed case of an ICE detainee with the new coronavirus, that's Domingo Garcia, president of the League of United Latin American Citizens. Senator Bernie Sanders is the only remaining 2020 presidential hopeful to speak to the dangers of virus spread among people in prisons, jails, and ICE detention centers. Garcia, again.
They're not going to have the health care, and then Border Patrol agents, Customs Patrol agents are going to get sick. They're going to spread it to their families and in their neighborhoods, and that could just become a huge human disaster.
Garcia represents the largest Hispanic organization in the U.S., calling for the immediate release of children and people with no criminal records or violent offenses.
We have children as young as 1 year old, up to 17, who are currently being detained for no other crime than looking for the American dream and believing the Statue of Liberty means something.
Attorney Bree Bernwanger with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights of San Francisco Bay Area is part of a lawsuit for the release of 12 medically vulnerable people in two Northern California facilities, the Mesa Verde Detention Center and Yuba County Jail.
We have clients experiencing flu-like symptoms who go into the medical staff and ask about COVID-19. They are told, don't worry about it. It's completely incompatible with public health responses around the country, but it is consistent with what our clients have told us about the absolute disregard for their health and well-being.
Bernwanger says her group can't find evidence of testing in either facility, and she believes that's not uncommon.
ICE detention centers around the country have been notorious for a long time in failing to provide adequate medical care and medical responses to emergent conditions.
Now jails and detention centers join other facilities in lacking necessary procedures and equipment. President Trump has declined to order companies to make much-needed ventilators through the Defense Production Act, saying enough manufacturers have volunteered. But with the current shortage, the Advanced Medical Technology Association said their members would, quote, appreciate the administration's leadership, unquote, on which orders to fill first. Yesterday, the Senate passed a $2 trillion coronavirus stimulus bill. It was delayed because three Republican lawmakers were concerned the short-term increase in unemployment payments would incentivize layoffs and joblessness. But some Democrats, including Sanders, insisted on benefits for working people. The bill also includes $400 million to shore up elections and promote mail-in voting during the COVID-19 outbreak. Amber McReynolds from the National Vote at Home Institute says the November election can't be canceled.
So we really need to provide options for voters, and we need to do it quickly.
Yesterday, former Vice President Joe Biden shrugged off Sanders' suggestion to debate again, saying, quote, "We've had enough debates," unquote. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
States and counties across the U.S. are considering whether to release some people from prison, especially those convicted of nonviolent offenses, to help slow the spread of COVID-19 in overcrowded jails and prisons. Suzanne Potter has more.
Civil rights advocates are praising L.A. County's release of 1,700 people in jail for nonviolent offenses in an effort to fight COVID-19 infections, but they also say more needs to be done. The L.A. County Sheriff's Department released 10% of the jail population. So far, no one behind bars in L.A. has tested positive for the virus, but Peter Eliasberg with the ACLU of Southern California says it's only a matter of time.
And the minute that starts happening, the more people are there, the more people are going to get it in the jails, and then many of those people are going to come out in the community and going to be flashpoints for further transmission.
The L.A. County Board of Supervisors has asked the county health officer to issue a public health order that would empower the sheriff to release more people, particularly those with fewer than 30 days remaining on their sentences. Opponents of the move say releasing people early could lead to more crime. The Drug Policy Alliance is calling for jails and prisons across the country to release most people who are over age 60 and those who have underlying medical conditions that make them more vulnerable to a viral infection. Eliasberg says the authorities won't release people convicted of violent offenses.
We're facing the greatest public health threat in 100 years, so that has to be the number one thing we focus on, the threat that probably millions of people will be exposed to it. I think that's the greatest public safety risk we've got to worry about, not an increase in crime.
Civil rights groups are also calling on judges to allow more people to await trial at home, especially those picked up on immigration offenses. On Wednesday, Senator Kamala Harris co-sponsored a bill to open community release programs to people in federal prisons who are pregnant, over age 50, or who have underlying health issues. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
There is an important update in the fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline. The Army Corps of Engineers has been ordered to perform an environmental impact study, and construction cannot move forward until it's completed. With that story and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has been ordered to complete a meaningful environmental impact study on the Dakota Access Pipeline. A federal judge issued that order Wednesday and will consider whether to shut the pipeline down until the study is complete. A lawyer for the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe says it's about time. Victoria Wicks reports.
Federal Judge James Boasberg says in his written opinion that too many questions remain unanswered when it comes to the safety of the Dakota Access Pipeline, or DAPL. Boasberg says the Corps did not adequately address concerns raised by tribe's experts that the pipeline suffered from serious flaws that could result in extensive environmental harm in the event of a spill. The judge notes that the Corps instead relied on reports drawn up by a third-party contractor working for DAPL and came to the conclusion that the pipeline's crossing under the Missouri River does not pose significant environmental risks. Jan Hasselman of Earth Justice represents the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe.
The order to require a full environmental impact statement is a huge victory for the tribe. It's what we've been asking for since the very beginning of the process. It will finally provide some transparency and some accountability about the risks and impacts of spills and what it would mean for the Standing Rock people and others.
Hasselman says the Corps has pointed to leak detection systems as ensuring safety, but those systems have been shown to fail 80% of the time. He says it makes sense to shut the pipeline down, at least for now.
In our view, it is totally inappropriate to continue operating a pipeline with known risks to the tribe while it's being studied.
The judge has instructed tribes and the Corps to submit briefs arguing the issue of pipeline closure. I'm Victoria Wicks.
Volunteers in Rapid City, South Dakota are putting care packages together for Native elders as many are finding it tough to get needed supplies amid COVID-19. China Lockett has more.
Sunny Red Bear and her partner are delivering supplies to seniors in predominantly Native communities.
We're starting in Lakota homes, and after today, we'll reach about 55 homes so far.
Their project started about a week ago. Packages include canned goods, grooming, and cleaning supplies.
Our goal is just to continue to take in donations and at least to have our elders have a kind of a startup package of things that they're going to need during this time in quarantine, because a lot of the supplies out there is very limited, and then also they don't necessarily have the transportation or the capability of going out themselves and getting these things.
Red Bear says this can be a lonely time for elders, and they want this effort to remind them they matter. Nicole Bossner is Sunny's partner. She says only they handle the packages and deliveries. They wear gloves and take precautions to keep recipients safe.
Everybody has been super grateful with what we've been giving them. Sunny and I have just tried to focus on essentials for a household. We visited a few elders who hadn't left their house in about 7 days. So we just want to make sure that they have like things that we would personally use in our home.
Bossner says people nominate elders to receive care packages on Facebook, then send the names and addresses for deliveries.
We just want to make sure that our elders are taken care of. A lot of elders, especially in the Native American community, are normally raising their grandkids and their great-grandkids, so a lot of them are in need of more supplies.
The women are working with a nonprofit that will cover any taxes on monetary donations. If possible, they may also consider reoccurring deliveries for elders. I'm Trina Lockett in Rapid City.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 26, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Jenka Soderberg, Melissa Hood, Daniel Conway, Jeffrey Wade, Althea Billings, and Annette Newell. The producer is Annette Newell. Our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, and Suzanne Potter. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Stay tuned for KBOO News In Depth, where our own Jenka Soderberg will be speaking about data privacy in the age of coronavirus. Stay with us.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Right now, we face an unprecedented moment in this country and around the world. Things are changing quickly. Every day, there are new updates about federal, state, and local efforts to slow down the spread of the virus and save lives. While many of these efforts are valiant, important, and life-saving, others are causing concerns among online privacy advocates and social justice activists. For example, reports of increased surveillance and GPS tracking for the enforcement of stay-at-home orders, government and social media sites censoring content and information, the U.S. Department of Justice requesting the ability to detain people indefinitely without trial, and the potential for more authoritarian actions that aren't medically necessary. In the U.S., the government is talking to companies like Google, Facebook, and Clearview AI, which is a less-than-reputable firm specializing in facial recognition technology, about ways to access location tracking data from smartphones and engage facial recognition for tracking purposes. The governments of Israel, Singapore, and Australia have already implemented such location tracking. In addition, schools are turning to online learning and businesses to online conferencing software, bringing the potential for online privacy breaches, hacks of personal data, and mass surveillance of communication. Lindsay Oliver is with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I spoke with her earlier today.
We are joined on the line now by Lindsay Oliver. She's activism project manager at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is a group that has worked to preserve online privacy for many years now. And the group EFF has put out a guide to what people should know about online tools being used during the COVID-19 crisis. I know a lot of people are working online for the first time. Some of the ones that are being used by schools are things like Bark, Go Guardian, Gaggle, Social Sentinel, which are things that EFF has brought up in the past as concerns for student privacy. Maybe we could just start with that on the educational side. What are some of the ways that this online schooling and online teaching is affecting students' privacy?
Absolutely. So on the student privacy side of things, we're seeing a lot of kids having to move to doing homeschooling or online learning. And many of the schools are sending kids home with school-issued devices that have basically spyware installed on them. They're monitoring all of the papers that students are writing in some cases. In other scenarios, schools are employing social media monitoring to check up on what students are doing online and outside of school hours. And it's pretty invasive software that really breaks down trust between students and their schools and their teachers, and really makes for a learning environment where, you know, surveillance is a prerequisite for an education.
Wow. And what about some of the arguments that people make that, well, this surveillance technology isn't such a harmful thing for young people if they've done nothing wrong, they have nothing to hide? I know EFF has countered that argument. I wonder if you could talk about that.
People want to maintain their privacy for a variety of reasons. And I would call that that argument that people put forth that, you know, if you've done nothing wrong, you have nothing to hide, honestly a myth. You may want to keep a private conversation between you and your partner private. You may want to keep conversations that you're having with your healthcare provider private. So the argument that, you know, if you've done nothing wrong, you've got nothing to hide, it's based on an incorrect assumption that only, like, bad people or people who broke the rules, they're the only ones who want privacy. And it comes down to one simple question. What do you want to protect? The fact that you, you know, talk to your doctor about a private health concern. Maybe you are attending a political rally. Maybe you are organizing for a cause. Maybe you would like to keep conversations with your partner private. Those are all things that you shouldn't have to give someone else access to. You should have privacy, and that doesn't stop if you're a student.
Yeah, and you mentioned healthcare. That's something that I don't know if a lot of people realize, but during this particular COVID-19 crisis, the Department of Health and Human Services has actually altered the HIPAA rules to allow healthcare providers to use online applications to speak with patients. What should people do if they're having a teleconference with their healthcare provider and they're concerned about privacy? Are there steps that they can take?
I would talk to your healthcare provider about what the applications are that they're using, and what they're doing to safeguard your privacy, and what steps they may be taking in the future to move back to HIPAA compliance.
Why is online privacy something that is important to actually pay attention to during a crisis? Some people might say, well, this is an emergency. We don't have the time or bandwidth to worry about online privacy at a time like this?
In times like this, it's honestly, we're all pretty scared. And it's important that people are informed about the potential privacy risks of the tools that we're all moving on to as we social distance, as we remain in isolation. Lots of organizers and caregivers, schools and workplaces, they're all using new platforms, and they may not be aware of the potential for their data and the data of at-risk people to be exposed. Say you're organizing for a cause, or you are trying to provide mutual aid to marginalized or at-risk people. If you're using applications that have the potential to leak that data or have a third-party hacker get a hold of it, you want to be aware of that risk before you start using it so that you can plan and try to mitigate and minimize the data that can be leaked.
Especially with the possibility that this type of technology would then be in place once this crisis is ended and would continue to be used. I mean, that's something that I know is a concern, especially regarding like facial recognition technology in order to try and identify who has the virus and is not going into quarantine or that kind of thing.
Absolutely. And that's something that we're concerned about as well. We're looking into it and monitoring. One of the recommendations that I would make for folks who are concerned about this is to stay informed. The Electronic Frontier Foundation does a lot of work in this area, and we also provide a lot of resources and tools for helping keep you safe online. A great place to stay in the know is to sign up for EFF's newsletter, Effector. And then for tools and resources, I would highly recommend going and checking out Surveillance Self-Defense, which is at ssc.eff.org. That is a repository of online tools, how-tos, installation guides, and deep dives to help you understand how to circumvent surveillance, how to keep you and your loved ones safe through this crisis and beyond.
Yeah, thanks. And especially any students that are doing online learning, there's a whole section on that website, ssd.eff.org. That's Surveillance Self-Defense, ssd.eff.org. And it's a privacy for students. It talks about some of the technology that's used by schools and how it affects students and what they can do about it. Lindsay, I want to thank you so much for joining us on KBOO today. Again, I've been speaking with Lindsay Oliver, who's Activism Project Manager at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF. Thanks for being with us today, Lindsay.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO Radio.
Another major concern with the spread of COVID-19 is the situation in the nation's prisons. With 2.3 million people imprisoned in the United States, prisons are overcrowded and often unsanitary. An outbreak in a prison would likely spread like wildfire. As the U.S. appears to be about 10 days behind Italy in the spread of the virus, it's important to look at what has happened there. Italian news agencies reported prison riots in 27 different Italian prisons across the country. 6 inmates were killed and prison staff were taken as hostages. The riots began as fears of contagion rose among an overcrowded prison system that's 20% above capacity. The inmates had also had their movements restricted and had been cut off from social visits. As of last week, the Federal Bureau of Prisons has suspended all social visits, legal visits, and transportation of inmates between institutions in the United States. The National Association of Defense Lawyers said that given the volume of incarcerated people in the U.S., the conditions under which they are detained, and the current spread of the COVID-19 coronavirus, there is every reason to question whether American detention facilities as a whole are up to this challenge. For more, I spoke with James Scott, an inmate on death row in San Quentin, California.
Speaking with James Scott at San Quentin Prison on death row, can you talk about what is happening there in regards to the COVID-19 pandemic? Are they taking precautions? Are people able to have social distancing measures? What's happening at San Quentin?
I can only speak for my little block right here. You know, they're taking precautions here in these blocks. And, you know, yes, they are practicing social distancing. And, you know, I mean, the medical is on the doing their job, the bottom line is. You know, I can't speak what's going on outside this particular block I'm in, like I say, you know, but where I'm at, they're being very professional about the health of the prison right now.
Well, what does that mean to do social distancing in a prison? Does it mean that you end up being in lockdown for a lot longer than you're used to?
Well, no, it's not so many. What it is the fact that no one, I mean, normally, like, they'll have yards. You have seven different yards. And now it's only 40 people out there instead of the polls, maybe about 100. And then maybe it's not even 40 people going because everybody don't go out. So it's basically they're keeping us from any kind of pandemic occurring right here on the road. But now what's happening outside of here, I don't know.
Mm. You know, well, I know in Rikers,
you know, we had a common cold.
There was a prisoner that came down as positive in Rikers, and a lot of people, including Representative Hakeem Jeffries, have called for release of prisoners in order to avoid the pandemic spreading like wildfire in a prison, which is likely what would happen given the crowded conditions in many of the prisons. But you're saying that they're able to separate people there on death row?
Yes, yes, no doubt about that. They will, if anyone exhibits any type of cough, fever, so on and so forth, they will automatically remove them and take them to the adjustment center, you know, where it's a cell with a hard door and so on and so forth, where they'll be isolated for 14 days. And then they'll come back over here once they determine if they have COVID or just a regular cold or flu or what have you.
Well, and I suppose if there was any prisoner release, you on death row would be the last in line to be released.
Of course. I doubt if we would be released. They'd probably spread us out then if they release a whole lot of people up out of these blocks. So, you know, you might have, instead of having 57 people on a tier, you might have 30 people on a tier. You know, so, yeah, I doubt they would allow that to take place. Mm-hmm. They have something like that in the Daily Journal that I was reading last night, where people have rallied and petitioned the governor, asking him to release people 60 years old and up out of this prison system that have, you know, chronic illnesses. Now, no doubt about that, there's a lot of people here who have health issues that are chronic. You know, chronic. And I do believe they should be released. You know, there's a lot of 70-year-olds, a lot of people in their late 60s whose health has really deteriorated right here on the road. So I can only imagine what it is out there on the main line. There's an ailing, elderly populace of prisoners who have been down 30, 40, 50 years.
And
I forgot about that.
What are health conditions like normally at the prison? I understand past diseases that have gotten into the prisons have spread very quickly once they do get in.
Well, yes, you know, I mean, you didn't have, what's that, the norovirus, and so, I mean, you know, that's the pandemic. You know, I mean, norovirus, Legionnaire disease, all kinds of stuff is taking place right here in San Quentin in the last, 10 years. But what can you do? We're up under the ward, as they say, we're a ward of the state. So basically, you get an aspirin and hopefully you'll get some real medication, but that likely won't happen until either you pass away or you recover. That's just the way it is.
And for people who think that those on death row are kind of the worst of the prison population, I wonder if you could just briefly say your experience and how you ended up on death row for a crime that you didn't actually commit at all.
Wow, that's a long story, Jing. You've been knowing me for over 25 years, and you know my struggle. It started out, I was arrested for a heinous crime, you know, against a young lady that I did not do. I was implicated by an individual who was a professional informant for the sheriff's department. And I was drugged, given Miller-Real 650 milligrams three times a day. Then it was up to 750 milligrams three times a day until I ended up pleading guilty to a crime I don't remember pleading guilty to. I ended up in Chino Prison. And that's when I found out how much time I had. At that time, I had pled guilty to 42 years. And then they took me back down to the county jail almost 2 years later. And when I went down there, no one read me my rights. I ended up going back to the courthouse. And the same guy that represented me comes around, you know, sits down, and he's like, I'm representing you, you know, person in question died, and they want you to testify against the individual, which they know he had something to deal with. The DA willing to offer me 15 years of life. I said, what, I'm going to take 15 years of life for something I didn't do. And I'm not going to get on the stand and lie on him like he did me. Well, no, to no avail, I ended up getting the death penalty. I mean, but it's a long story, and I'm going to write it out so individuals can hear what I'm having to say. But I'm only one of a multitude from Southern California that experienced the atrocity.
This call and or telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
This judicial system, you know, and I ended up having a, it's just hard. I mean, my heart is starting to pound right now, so forgive me, but we will have more on the story later. But
I hope when you put out those memoirs that we'll be able to talk about that and share that story with the KBOO listeners so people realize that not everyone on death row is these worst of the worst people that we're led to believe. Again, thank you.
What we are is a diversion. That's all it is. Let's keep it real. We are a diversion. Many of us haven't been out 20, 30, 30-something years, haven't even been on the streets, but yet we are always rehashed when it's time to put a panic in the streets. Look what's going on now. Look what's taking place. Look at this pandemic. Don't just look at the pandemic. Just look at the representatives that we have. They're out of touch. They're 70, 60-year-old individuals who don't know what you're going through, don't know what it's like to be hungry, don't know what it's like to go to sleep at night with no lights on. So, you know, I mean, everybody has a story. Everybody has a story. And that's all I can say at this moment, because right now, you know, every time I talk about my story, you didn't see me digging. You sit in a visceral with me. You know how I get. And it's just, it's like I've been saying the same thing over and over and over and over again. And it's tedious. And it's like it's falling on deaf ears. I thank you. I thank the listeners. I thank the people. I right now need to rally together and help each other. Help each other. That's all you can do right now. Help each other. Then you can help us. But if there's no you, then there's no us. Thank you,
James Scott, speaking to us from San Quentin Prison in San Quentin, California.
New York has now taken steps to release some prisoners. In New York City, Mayor Bill de Blasio announced this morning that he will release 1,000 prisoners charged with nonviolent offenses in order to relieve prison overcrowding. Senator Cory Booker has introduced a bill in Congress that would allow tens of thousands of people currently in federal prisons and jails to be released during the pandemic. Meanwhile, another vulnerable population, those living in the streets, have been left without a clear plan to weather this pandemic. The Stop the Sweeps Coalition in Portland has called for a moratorium on sweeps, as well as the placement of 150 hand-washing stations and restrooms throughout the city to support the estimated 4,000 people living on the streets in Portland. Vince is a member of the coalition. He is a houseless advocate who is himself houseless in southeast Portland.
Okay, we're joined now by Vince, who is one of the organizers with Stop the Sweeps here in Portland. It's a coalition of a number of groups that have been working since last year to end the sweeps of houseless camps here in the Portland area. And right now, with the COVID-19 pandemic sweeping across the country and Oregon, are you still facing sweeps? Is this something that is still going on?
I'll tell you from my perspective. So I am kind of someone who has been in a lot of places in Portland on the street. For me, I haven't had to worry personally about the sweeps in a year since I've been swept so many times last year that I just got the knack of it, you know, communicating with friends and allies. And then, you know, we come up with a system of this is how they post it. This is where they want you to go. They just want to clean it, whatever their system is. Right now, I'm not too familiar with how the police are out there doing their normal stuff, but I know the communities that have been holding their places because they've been out of sight under bridges, on the freeways, those places, you know, they've been fine for months. Usually they get cleaned up by the state, I believe, or ODOT. So those communities, as I've been traveling around trying to get information to them or, you know, find out who's sick or what's going on in there, I'm finding out that they're okay. They're just, you know, disconnected, obviously. No phones, no food access other than going to the stuff that's closing down, you know, and all the help is, you know, it's up in the air. And, they, you know, there's a lot of questions right now. There's a lot of questions. And there's people on the streets that are just going to make it work. You know, we're going to survive no matter what. We're not going to let this kill us. We didn't let anything else kill us. So why would this kill us? So we're just going to have to work together. And if that means we die together because we don't know how this illness works and because no medical community or help is coming to us, then we die. But I don't think that's going to be the case because the resources are coming in. You know, the goodness of humans is shining through, if you will. And that's, you know, that's the only thing that's going to be carrying us. And if Portland being, I think, the best place to be homeless in the city, then, you know, we'll just be the beacon for all the other places.
Wow.
At least in America. And then, you know, we'll work on the rest of the world.
Yeah. So yesterday, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler, for the first time, addressed whether houseless people would be subject to the social distancing guidelines that have been laid out by the governor, and said, yes, they would be. But how exactly does that work to stay home for someone who doesn't have a home?
Again, if there was a public announcement speech going on every corner of the city, then I would be safe knowing that every homeless person knows what Mayor Wheeler just said. And I've introduced Mayor Wheeler at the street response opening thing. You know, so I met him. He's complimented my glasses. I like the guy. He's okay. But, you know, I don't care what he says about what he thinks of homeless people because I don't see him on the streets. If he wants to take a night off and come out on the street and find out what's happening, I'll take him around, okay? I know five people. You know, we can all do the hazmat thing and go around. You know, we can look like idiots. But we can also just ride bikes around because that's what other people do in this city. We're just people in this city. So I'll follow the leadership of someone who says this is where the resources are coming, where do we put them, okay? And, you know, I'll just tell people where to go with that, and then hopefully the resources get where they want to go. I just want to be a part of helping.
Yeah, and I know a lot of people are with the PDX COVID-19 mutual aid group starting and just trying to provide food for people and make sure that people have what they need. Has that group been a part of helping houseless camps and people who are stuck on the street at this time?
You know, I bet that could be directed better to the Stop the Streets campaign as a general. I only know from a couple of avenues. I know a couple of allies that are coming through, Sisters of the Road, street groups are holding down. You know, so there are people, too, that are dying. And Hygiene for All is another one that's starting up and it's getting busier than ever because, you know, it's time for, like, really emergency bathrooms at least. Let's figure that out, and then we'll figure out how to pay for it later. So, you know, the people that were working on this before it was a crisis – you know, they're rolling the wheels faster than ever to try to come up with solutions, you know, instead of waiting for whatever. The money from Trump, that's not even going to be for homeless people. It's just going to be, I don't know. Well, that's not even going to be an issue.
And what about this proposal to open the convention center to allow houseless people to take shelter there?
Yeah. I mean, that's great. I mean, we need 40 of them, to be honest. I don't know why the convention center only fits less people or more, as many as Right to Dream, which is across the street, looks, you know, a lot less pretty. But, you know, those people have been there for, all, you know, as long as Right to Dream 2 has been there. So if you don't know what that is, please look it up. It's a shelter for almost the overflow traffic of the Portland Rescue Mission and other places that overflow. And then when people get overflowed for Right to Dream, they just have to sleep outside. And when, you know, the hospitals need to drop off someone because they had a bad night, they bring them right to Right to Dream. So we're in a, you know, Right to Dream shelters, all of that, as long as they stay together and focus on, you know, what's important here, the curing, health, illness, medicine, getting the resources to the right places, And any shelter is good. Every shelter is good. Anyone that is outside and needs to be inside, wants to be inside, ought to be. But then there's the other side, which is just, you know, the people that are outside, we've been outside this whole time, you know, and now you're going to come put us in some shelter, some wapato. Like, you know, honestly, how do you think that's going to roll out? Like, are you going to bring the police out? Like, think about it. That's just where I'm at. I'm so confused.
And I know the demands of the Stop the Sweeps PDX Coalition include access to health and hygiene supplies, including a demand for 150 hand-washing stations and bathrooms across the city, as well as medical support. And as you're talking about how are you going to force people to go into a shelter, maybe the convention center would be more like the warming shelter where people can drop in as needed.
That would be great. Anywhere information is good, if it's clean, it's disinfected, absolutely. The cleaner, the better. Just the way things have been going, I mean, I just don't see, everyone has to worry about themselves now, which is what a crisis is, which is like what happens in wartime, you know, with our wartime president, apparently. So everyone's in crisis. They have to buckle down and figure out, how am I getting myself, my family, through this time period, okay? Now, the homeless folks, they have very different types of families, and we are maybe even just one big family. So we're going to be doing the same thing. We're one family in Portland, at least. So we're going to try to figure this out with whatever resources we've got. And, you know, we're just going to have to weather it. And, you know, hopefully we'll not lose a single person. But we've lost people to just the weather in this city. So I don't know what people expect is going to happen the next couple of weeks.
Right. And I know it's a family that has a lot of support, at least from some parts of the housed community in Portland. So if people do want to step up and support the work that Stop the Sweeps is doing, how can they do that or find out more information?
You know, I'm actually hoping you could tell me the email just now. I have a bunch of friends that have been contacting me, just making sure I'm okay doing what I'm doing. So if you could share, whoever within that group would like to be the communications, you know, organizer through that, please. They are the person I trust.
Right. And the Stop the Sweeps Coalition is calling on people to actually call elected officials and to ensure that housing is a human right and that the people who are unhoused right now are provided for during this crisis. And you can find information and get connected to them. There is a Stop the Sweeps group on Facebook, and there is an email address, stopthesweepspdx@gmail.com. I want to thank you, Vince, for joining us on KBOO today. Is there anything else you want to add?
You know, I guess final words, just, you know, it's not even as big as the homeless crisis. It is as small as just your neighbor. Like, just look to the neighbor next to you. If you don't really know them that well, you know, ask them this week, you know, how they're doing. And find out, you know, if there's anything you can do to help. And then just let that trickle down. Don't let the money trickle down. Let the generosity trickle down. That's what I'm hopeful for Portland. You know, I think we can lead this country by example, at least with the homeless issue in this fight. Thank you.
All right. So reach out to your neighbor, whether that neighbor is housed or unhoused. Thank you so much, Vince, for joining us on KBOO today.
Thank you. Thank you, KBOO. You guys really are the voice out there.
And this is Jinka Soderberg with KBOO Radio.
You've been listening to KBOO News In Depth. Remember, you can tune into KBOO any time of the day and night. We are here for you, your community radio station. You can also look at our website, kboo.fm, and we have a special page linking to the audio that's being produced around this pandemic and other information and resources that are available. The website page is kboo.fm/COVID-19. This is Jenka Soderberg for KBOO News In Depth. I stood looking at my former hood, felt the spirit in the wind, knew my friend was gone for good. Through dirt on the casket, the hurt I couldn't mask it, mix it down, emotion, struggle I hadn't mastered. I choreographed 7 steps to heaven, inhale, waiting to exhale and make the bread leaven. Veteran of a cold war, it's the guy I go for, what I know or what's known. So some days I take the bus home, just to touch home, from the crib I spend months gone. Sat by the window with a clutch stone, listening to shorties cuss long. Young girls are weak minds, but they butt strong.
tried to call or at least speak the Lord, but didn't have a touchstone. It's a dog and dog world, you got a must own. Some of this land I must own. Out of the city, they want us gone. Tearing down the checks, creating plush homes. My circumstance is between Cabrini and Love Jones. Surrounded by hate, yet I love home. Ask my guy how he thought traveling the world sound. Found it hard to imagine he hadn't been past downtown. It's deep, I heard the city breathing his sleep. A reality I touch, but for me it's hard to keep. It's deep, I heard my man breathing his sleep. A reality I touch, but for me it's hard to keep. So much on my mind, I just can't recline. Blasting holes in the night till she bless sunshine. Breathing in hell vapors from bright stars to shine. Breathe out. Smoke retrace the skyline. You heard a bass ride out like an ancient maiden call. I can't.